This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I'm really hoping that I am not coming in tomorrow, because if I come in tomorrow, it means there's something wrong. And it's been one of those weeks that hasn't been a bad week, but there have been a few challenges this week. But I am going home at the end of this week, and I think most of the challenges have been addressed. Yay! Every month end, especially this time of year, we get a lot of extra work for our contributor services people, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, everything is increasing at this time of the year, and we've been having some trouble with some slowness on our servers. And so it's just really good that, you know, we're in the kind of shape that we're in, because last night they rebooted a server that hadn't been rebooted in 400 days, and it actually came back up and it was working, yet mostly working. Yay! And in addition, that seemed to help some of our performance problems, and we found some other things to do, and we found some other things to tune, and so at this point, we look like we're pretty good on all fronts. So that's always nice. So we're going to do a little more tweaking tonight, but it should be fine. They do have to reboot the server again tonight because a piece of it didn't come up correctly. But hopefully that will all go fine. And then everything will be fine. Busy time of year all the way around. I'm rushing to try to get finished book 3 in the Windfall Saga. The Straight Gate, it is called. The editing's going fine. It's just, you know, there's a lot of editing and a lot of good input from the beta readers. And so I've got one more book to finish up. Hopefully we'll get that done tomorrow. Then I start my read-through. And once I get my read-through done, get it relayed out, you know, there's only a couple of days at that point, get it relayed out, tweak the cover just a little bit, because I had the wrong number for the thickness of a single page, and that caused my spine on my book to be a little oversized on the beta copies, but I'll get that corrected and get that all put together and then get copies ordered, and then as soon as I get those copies ordered, then I am back working on my read-through for book 4. It's always interesting because in this overlap, I kind of forget what as I'm writing the new book, I kind of forget all the ins and outs of the last book, and so then as I'm editing, I'm like, oh yeah, that's in there too. That was interesting. Oh yeah, that was in there too. Well, that was interesting. Oh yeah, that was... Then I'm like, oh, I gotta kick up the next book a little... Run, do better job. So as I'm re-editing book 4, what I expect is I'm going to go back in, put more atmosphere in, you know, put more emotional content in, kind of get up to the next level on it. And we'll see. It's interesting. Book 4, I'm halfway through it, and I know kind of where I'm going, but how all those lines actually resolve. Have no idea. So I'm just going to have to keep writing my way into it and hope that I can get everything closed up and sealed up in a fun, exciting, interesting way. I have, you know, about 200 more pages to write. And I've got plenty of threads out there now that need to all be collapsed and resolved. So we'll see if I can get them, you know, if I can get them all collapsed and resolved, that would be good. But, you know, Jesus has helped me so far, and he'll keep helping me, and we'll just keep moving forward step at a time. So that's good. My wife is really busy right at the moment because she's got both a children's musical and an adult musical coming up for Christmas. So she's working. Tonight we have the staff party for the church where we attend, where my son-in-law happens to be the pastor. So that's tonight. So I'm running home and, you know, it's either at 6 or 6:30. If it's at 6:30, I'm running home and doing some exercise and then grabbing a shower and we're heading back out again. If it's at 6, I may just do a little bit of exercising and then grab a shower and freshen up a little bit and head out. My dad's still recovering from his prostate surgery. Seems to be doing okay, better. We're just kind of dealing with all those things that you deal with. The 92 3/4. It's actually more than that now. It's 92 3/4. No, it's 5/6. Because he's 12 months. It's 10 months into it now. And so he only has 2 more months till he turns 93. Actually, less than 2 months until he turns 93, because his birthday is on January the 19th. So we are already into December, and he's coming up to just 1 month. He'll be 92 11/12 here soon, which is amazing to him and is amazing to me. But I'm grateful that he's still here, because that helps. Means that he and my mom can still be quasi-independent. So that's all going well. Haven't really seen the grandkids lately much, because they've been sick, and Liz and Alan, our kids, have been sick, and so, and I have another buddy who's been sick, but it's been a good week. I've had some nice conversations this week, with friends, and it's been a good week. Really has. Maybe it was last week. So I was preparing some supper one day. Just kind of moving around on Netflix and ended up, and I had seen something in the queue on Netflix a couple of times. And I decided, all right, fine. You know, it was a stand-up comedian thing. And I thought, all right, fine. And it's not necessarily something I would recommend people watch. Certainly not something I would recommend the faint of heart to watch. But I do think it is something that has a profound and important lesson to teach us. And I don't necessarily want to give away the punchline. If it could be called a punchline, it certainly affected me when we made the transition. So if you are ever going to watch this, which be warned, it's pretty rough in terms of language and subject matter, you should listen to this podcast after you watch it. So assuming that you're not going to watch it because it's pretty rough in language and subject matter, I'll just tell you the name of it and then we'll talk about why I felt like it was important that I had watched it once it was finished. The name of the documentary was called Call Me Lucky. And it was a documentary on the life of Barry Crimmins, who I had not heard of before. In fact, it was a documentary by Bobcat Goldthwait, which I didn't even recognize, the comedian, I didn't even recognize him when he showed up on camera. I mean, it looks like he's trying to kind of get clean and sober and you know, trying to clean up a little bit. I thought the documentary was very well done. I thought it was shot well. I thought it was edited well. It's called Call Me Lucky, which you really don't find out until you get to the end of the documentary. And again, massive spoilers ahead for this documentary. So if you have not seen it yet, but you have it on your list and you're going to watch it, and you've decided to do that already, you should probably not listen to this podcast until after you watch it. So it starts out kind of reviewing the life of Bob Crimmins. And it starts off really talking about his life as a comedian. And, you know, he obviously a lot of language in his expletives and in his routines, and a lot of vitriol, a lot of attacks on the Catholic Church and on anything kind of establishment, on the presidents. I mean, just haranguing vitriol. And in fact, they had one section where some heckler called out, and I mean, he just tears into this heckler and just rips him up one side down the other. I mean, this is a man who is, won't say very angry inherently, but there is certainly a lot of rage and anger within him. Turns out he's had a very influential career, maybe not a well-known career, but a very influential career. I mean, he started two different comedy nightclubs in Boston, one called the Ding Ho and the other called Stitches. And there were multiple comedians of note that came through those clubs: Stephen Wright, Kevin Meaney, Dennis Leary, Paula Poundstone. You know, which they all kind of have that kind of edge to them. Crimmins was also a performer among them, and I mean, he really, really had some very intense material. They're quoted at one point is saying about him that he was always angry about something, and he did not suffer fools kindly. And so, you know, as I'm watching, as and of course it's an onstage persona, but still, as you're watching it, it's a good conservative boy with a religious background who loves God, yada yada, it's quite easy to take offense at a lot of the things that he's saying. Now, of course, I understand that when he's talking about religion, he's really talking about organized religion. He's not talking about a real relationship with Jesus Christ. And even as I was listening to him talk about all those things, there was a part of me that was just so sad that he apparently had not had anyone in his life that could really image the true love and grace and kindness and mercy of God. And I'm really, really glad that I decided to just keep watching. And I think maybe one of the reasons that I did is that I could tell it wasn't just a stand-up comedian going through his material. Although I have suffered through some of those as well, that would definitely be not be something that is on the watch list of the people I would know, and many among the people I would know would be stunned to find out I've watched some of the comedians that I've watched all the way to the end. And it's not because I have some prurient interest in their material. Although I will say that if nothing in their material rises above something that is intending to simply generate a prurient interest, that at that point I will stop. For me to keep watching, I've got to have something that shows that this person is thinking, that they have a viewpoint that's an interesting viewpoint on life, that they are attempting to understand the life that they are experiencing, and in the process, I'm trying to understand the life that they are experiencing so I can understand their viewpoint, so that if I ever encounter someone like that, at least I have the basic starting point for opening a conversation that, given enough time, will lead somewhere good. So I do subject myself to things that would normally be highly offensive to others, simply because I am trying to understand cultural differences and trying to understand other viewpoints so that there is the potential to establish relationship. So anyways, but about the first 45 minutes of the documentary really just goes through his materials and his haranguing against the injustices in the world, which there are plenty of injustices in the world, until you come to an evening in 1992 where he bared his soul and his secrets to an audience. I should also mention that he mentions several times the Catholic Church and disparages the Catholic Church quite often, and in fact mentions a priest who was in his church, who he was terrified of, who was just really mean to him, who in the early days he was trying to be an altar boy, and the priest started giving him a shoulder rub at one point, and he back elbowed the priest. And after that, the priest was just, you know, really always filled with vitriol and talking to him, and was always looking to belittle him and put him down. And so I was thinking, well, okay, you know, I can understand where some of this is coming from. But what he describes, and again, if you are thinking about watching this documentary, you should stop now. Even though I really can't recommend that you watch the documentary per se, because it is tough and it deals with some very tough subject matter. But if you want to continue, what he reveals to an audience about 45 minutes in to the documentary is the fact that as a young boy, as a really cute, curly-headed, sweet little boy, that when his parents would hire a babysitter, the babysitter boyfriend would come over to the house and take him down in the basement and rape him repeatedly. Which is, of course, horrific. And that, in fact, the babysitter would shove his face, or the babysitter's boyfriend would shove his face into the cushion so people couldn't hear him scream. And, in fact, he almost died from asphyxiation. And, you know, so he lived with this. His sister at one point came in and saw what was happening and gave him some reprieve from it, but, you know, he did endure this, which you can understand how that would create a lot of animosity and a lot of anger in him. But what he went on to do with that was that in the early days of AOL, when he first started getting on the internet, he ended up discovering chat rooms and looking down the list of some of the chat rooms where the titles of the chat rooms made it very clear that this is where pedophiles were coming to exchange techniques to upload videos. He said there were people on these chat rooms that were complaining about the fact that they were spending $1,200 a month on AOL fees, because in the olden days, when it was all dial-up, you were charged for connect time. There wasn't just pay a flat monthly fee and you could connect as much as you want. And these guys were just getting hammered with connect fees because they were spending so much time on these chat rooms uploading videos of children that they had abused, or they were passing around video. I mean, just horrible, horrible stuff going on. And nobody seemed to care. And Barry Crimmins was one of the people that was campaigning and campaigning. In fact, ended up testifying before Congress. A lot of the members in the Congress just had no idea what he was talking about. And they say, look, we're not technological. We don't understand this. And so he's trying to explain. And he's sitting next to the AOL guy. And the AOL guy's going, well, you know, we kind of watch this and we make sure. But, you know, there is the issue of freedom of speech and all this. And Barry Crimmins is just saying, look, this is criminal. And, I mean, he's campaigning and doing this tremendous work trying to shut down these pedophiles on AOL. And this section of the documentary, when you see how he's taking what happened to him and channeling it in such a way that he's trying his best to bring some protection, to bring some enforcement into things that are allowing horrific things to occur, obviously it's going to change your attitude towards this guy. He isn't someone who's just angry for no reason. He isn't someone who's just railing because he wants to be a contrarian. He actually deeply believes in social justice, and he is doing whatever he can to cause there to be a change. One moment, I'm getting my mail. So, you know, it's a fascinating thing to me to see that in the context of how I was feeling in the early part of watching this documentary. But it has a very touching ending where they finally explain the title. And again, if you're planning on watching this and you don't want the title spoiled, don't listen to this right now. But at the end of it, he's actually visits. They take him back to this house where this abuse happens when he was young. And, you know, they show him going down in the basement, and it's very haunting. So, just a second. I'm actually going to put this on pause because I'm going to say hello to neighbor. Okay, I'm back. That was the daughter of our neighbor came over, show me her little dog, or the little teacup Yorkshire Terrier, whatever it is. Anyways, let's see what I was talking about. I think I remember. So, anyways, they take him down in this basement. And, you know, he's talking about the thing. And it's interesting because in the basement, Bob Goldthwait kind of swings away from him, the camera. So you're just looking at this basement where this, and you can just hear him talking off to the side, Barry Crimmins. And he says, I don't see myself as a victim. So I'm not a victim. Or this is after the visit. He said, well, not anymore. He said, I'm a witness, which I thought that's really good. And then he continues, it's not like it killed me. He said, it almost killed me, but I'm still here. So you can call me lucky. And I mean, it's very poignant. And what I got out of all of that was not necessarily all of his vitriol and all of his anger. And it wasn't really even all of his crusading and all the wonderful things that he's done to try to keep this from happening to other children. But what I came away from it was how easy it would have been and how I did come close to listening to the first 15 or 20 minutes of this and then just going, yeah, I don't think that's what I want to listen to. And instead of getting offended, just allowing it to go a little farther and then realizing that what I was really hearing here was a wounded soul. And yet, in the midst of that wounding and in the midst of the horrible things he had experienced, he is, in fact, in my opinion, doing the work of the kingdom. You know, he is trying to seek and save, trying to protect, trying to make whole those who have been wounded and those who have been forsaken and those who have been abused. And I think sometimes it's just entirely too easy for us to be offended and to turn our backs when what we should really be doing is listening and trying to find ways to establish relationships. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.